Welcome everyone to the Friday night public discussion group of Perfecting Horizons Institute. We are in paper 63, section 7, which is old single column page 717. So we just have that final little section to go here in this paper. They've given us the historical story, and we just need to put a little cherry on top. You can see from the title about what became of Andon and Fanta when they died. And everyone knows it's a tiny little section, but there's a number of fun little tidbits in here. We certainly didn't want to force it in at the end of the preceding session here and give it its due beginning of this one. And then we'll be moving, into the next paper. Just give you a little preface on that to begin with. I've hinted at it a couple times. They're done with their little kind of aside, and we're going to go back into the chronological step-by-step mode and look, take a pass through the past million years one more time, only this time focused on the beings on the planet in contrast to the things. Remember, we're basically talking about the Ice Age, only passed through the past million years that first time we did it, back a little ways. So we're going to go back into that mode where we have paragraphs, starting with so many, years ago mode. But let's get this, we might find ourselves talking quite a bit on this. There's all sorts of potential tangents here. We'll see how it goes. Let's jump in to see what we've got here.
Number 7, the survival of Andon and Fanta. Andon and Fanta, the splendid founders of the human race, received recognition at the time of the adjudication of Urantia upon the arrival of the planetary prince. And in due time, they emerged from the regime of the mansion worlds with citizenship status on Gerasim. Although they have never been permitted to return to Urantia, they are cognizant of the history of the race they founded. They grieved over the Kalagash betrayal, sorrowed because the Adamic failure.
Because of the
Adamic failure. But rejoiced exceedingly when announcement was received that Michael had selected their world as the theater for his final bestowal.
Okay, so that quick little survey of the ups and downs in terms of famous off-worlders engaging our planet. Notice how it starts out. Again, emphasizing their exceptional nature relative to those that followed them, even immediately, the splendid founders of the human race. So that little bit of action of the whole, condensing just a little bit more into them to get things off. You might, to speak in kind of physics terms, The starting friction is a little greater than the sliding friction, so you got to give it a little bit more oomph to start with, right? To get it going, and then it'll stay going with less quote unquote splendor. And when they're saying, you know, splendid, it's a combination. The truth that flows through them is always, you know, it flows through any of us is splendid. They're obviously speaking more just about the fact of them, right? Factually, they were cut above. Okay, and then when they say received recognition at the time of the adjudication of Urantia upon the arrival of the planetary prince, and when you first, you know, read that, it's like, well, what are they talking about? Received recognition. Well, you keep reading, I see what they mean. This is when they were resurrected. And by saying it that way, so you go back, it's like, oh, they're pointing out that, yes, they're the splendid founders, but they didn't have a special resurrection for them. All right? Their sort of official recognition on high was 500,000 years later, right? They weren't resurrected for 500,000 years. Now, that first dispensational resurrection when the planetary prince arrived. So they were sleeping for a long, long time. From our, from an objective vantage point, from theirs, just like all of us, you close your eyes and you open your eyes, right? Whether it's, you know, 3 days like with Jesus here where no travel was required, or 500,000 years is irrelevant from the mortal's perspective. But, you begin to, contemplate that a little bit more. It's like, because we don't know about Onagar, maybe he might have been an exception. But in general, I mean, if these cut above the norm splendid founders didn't have a special resurrection for him, I mean, it seems to say that you can probably assume that essentially everyone, with maybe just a very few exceptions, someone like Onagar, maybe just one exception, were all sleeping and all resurrected at the same time, 500,000 years later, thousands and thousands at least, years later.
Even Moses, remember?
Yeah, right. I mean, yeah. I'm bringing that up because remember you have, and you mentioned Moses. I mean, besides having dispensational resurrections, there are millennial resurrections, and then there are, just completely whenever special resurrections. If there's some group of individuals that the powers that be, if you will, want to have on the mansion world sooner, then they'll resurrect, some group and feed them into the mix on the mansion worlds. As we'll see here in a second, and they talk a little bit more about them, you got to remember, these are quite primitive humans. So it's not surprising that the majority, if not all, basically all of them would just be lingering until a dispensational resurrection. Okay, and then, if 500,000 years isn't due time, there's even more due time. And in due time, they emerged from the regime of the mansion world with citizenship on Gerizim. And again, you wonder, it's like, does it naturally take longer for those sorts of individuals to go through the mansion worlds, or is it just slightly longer? I mean, you kind of work through the basics on the first and second mansion worlds, and then they pretty much can strike step with anyone. They never explain all those details to us. But just the fact that they say in due time, I mean, you know, is kind of hinting that, you know, it might have been a big chunk of time again. But regardless of how long the chunk of time, eventually, you're a Gerasim citizen. And then they throw in that interesting one, although they have never been permitted to return to your rancha. That may remind you of that one passage. Let's see, that's it's up there in paper 112, isn't it? And the end of section 3 in paper 112, where it says, those who go to the mansion worlds are not permitted to send messages back to their loved ones. It is a policy throughout the universes to forbid such communication during the period of a current dispensation. But you go back and look at, oh, that one's just talking about communication. And here we're actually talking about, you know, literally journeying here. We have no idea what the restrictions are on that sort of a, to come here as a visitor, as a Marantia being, come here, visit the world of your nativity. But there's obviously going to be some sort of a, you know, you could request it, but your request will be denied, most likely.
Gibbons are still.
And you'll see, you know, you may remember later we'll get to actual communication here, but just note that this is, you know, actually talking about, you know, journeying here. And then, you know, think between the lines of them commenting about the rebellion and the default and the fourth epical revelation, you know, the seventh bestowal of Michael. Besides the specifics, just in general, you don't have to come back here to keep track of your nativity sphere. From the mansion, you know, worlds, you can, you know, read the newspapers, quote unquote, right? I mean, there's all kinds of information that you'll have access to, and you can follow it in as much detail as you want, what's going on here, millennium after millennium. And it's, you know, I'm sure it's, you know, even the simplest information dispensation, is much more substantive than just, you know, ink on a white piece of paper, right? It's going to, you know, it's going to be a lot like, the next best thing to being there, I'm sure, in many ways. The way you will, you know, interface and gain this information, you're going to be getting it in a very, you know, sort of direct mindal fashion. So it will be a lot like, you know, experiencing it, you know, as if you had been there. Yep.
Kind of holistic.
Right. I'm sure it's going to be very holistic. You know, I mean, we can imagine things like, you know, holodecks and this sort of stuff, you know, and whatnot. But all that's pretty crude, I'm sure, relative to what you'll actually have there in terms of a very satisfying acquirement of knowledge about what's going on, not only on your nativity sphere, but other places. And the higher you ascend, I'm sure, the more you know you have access to. Okay, so that's the main thing that's between the lines there, is just reminding you of, we all need to be humble about this issue of being resurrected. Right? Whenever we're resurrected, it will be in due time. Right? Whether it's short or long, it will be the best time for you to be resurrected. You won't be able to look at it and say, well, if I had been in charge, obviously it would have been better. Yeah. But just, you know, appreciate your animal origin tendency right now to be hyperventilating about this, you know, and just trust, you know, let go. The fullness of time will be in play. Everyone has a place in the whole. And you will be resurrected just exactly when you should be, so that you have the best relationship to things and beings possible. Yeah. So if they can wait for 500,000 years, we can certainly wait for a little while. Because, you know, remember, you need to be a third circler to be resurrected on the third period. So,
yeah, but Chris, every time I hear of somebody passing, every Urantian I know of thinks that they're up there 3 days. Every time.
Yeah. But just, again, I'm saying, you know, just, you know, keep in mind that, you know, that's why I'm dwelling on this a while. Right? I mean, just, you know, appreciate what this is saying about us and our tension about time. You know, if your feet are planted in eternity, and your hands are working in time, in contrast to the way you start, the other way around, there's no difference between 3 days and 500,000 years. Right? Right? Both of those lengths of time are negligible in contrast to eternity. It's irrelevant. Right? So,
notice there's not anything in the list that says they were grieving about how long it took for the resurrection.
Yeah.
Well, just think how long it took for you just to start.
Yes, you think, if you think 500,000 years is a long time, you know, how about the 300 trillion years that preceded you, right? Yes. Okay. All right, let's get a little, throw in one other little chunk about this whole issue of with the adjusters.
Can I make a comment?
Oh, yeah, sure, go ahead.
They talk about the connection they still feel about your angel.
Yeah, yeah.
And I don't know, I just brought to mind a saying my wife, I think it's a family saying my wife remembers, about children being, when they're young, they're on your lap, and when they grow older, they're on your heart.
Oh.
And they still have this connection about the people that they were the forebears of.
Yeah, yeah. You know, and besides the fact that they have that extra element that they're the founders of the human race, we all will maintain an indelible link to our nativity sphere. You know, this is just inescapable. You know, we have shades of that. When we think about, you know, having a nation, right? I mean, whether or not you're a natural born citizen so that you can be president, right? Natural, nation, okay, they're the same word, right? You know, the question is, I mean, were you born in that place? A nation is a people of a place. Were you actually born in that place? And it's like, well, what difference does it make? It doesn't matter if you don't want it to make a difference. It does. You can't change the fact that you have a bond to the geographic place you were born. Right? That's why the idea of the Constitution was to make it so that the president, right, has that natural link to the place of this people, this nation, right? If he's going to be, you know, sort of the archetype individual of the nation, you know, Congress, okay, it's a different matter, right? You don't have to be natural born. But, see, I mean, what we're talking about here with nativity spheres is recognized, you know, on a smaller scale with humans. I mean, I was born in Boulder, Colorado. I lived lots of places. Huh, coincidentally, where am I now? Right? It's just innate that you you have a linkage. And even if you don't literally geographically come back like a yo-yo if you go away, you're, as you were saying, your quote-unquote heart, right? Your feelings, technically, of course, is what people mean by that. Your feelings have a bond to that location on the globe. Okay? That's just natural. Yeah, so...
Even if you lose your New York accent.
Yeah, yep. I mean, so when you're... when you have residential status on the Isle of Paradise, right, you'll still, you know, have one eye, if you will, kind of back on that nativity sphere. I wonder what's happening, you know, what's happened over the last 100 million years, you know, on your rancha.
We're still in the toilet.
It will be interesting.
We probably will have made it to light and life in 100 million years. Okay, yeah, so let's get into a little chunk here.
On Gerasim, both Andon and Fanta were fused with their thought adjusters, as also were several of their children, including Sontad, but the majority of even their immediate descendants only achieved spirit fusion.
Okay, so let's start with the final piece first here. But see, the majority of even their immediate descendants, so like I said, I mean, they're a cut above, you know, but very immediately, they're in the basic primitive human mode, where primitive humans are spirit fusers. It's not because they're not sangic. That's not the reason. And even when you're talking about having no pre-sangic race like this, and when the first humans or the first two, you know, come out of the red pre-human stock, they start out primitive humans, and in general, primitive humans are spirit fusers. Even the revelators don't understand all the physics of this. But there's something about, you know, what you have from the other parent, from your mother, that can't you know, go all the way to that fusion with that father fragment. You have to fuse with the mother fragment, a spirit fragment from the greater mother spirit. Yeah. And like I said, I mean, it's not under, the physics of that is not understood even by the revelators, you know, it, which is telling you it has to do with the inscrutable nature of the whole, right? And how, you know, when all is said and done, it's not like some are better or, you know, lesser or greater or anything. They're just different elements in the whole. You know, I mean, you can pretty quickly appreciate, I remember when we talked about spirit fusers before, a father fuser is just blowing through a local domain. I mean, you know, so they don't embody much more than a line through a local universe, you know, whereas the spirit fusers embody the wholeness eventually of a local universe. Someone has to do that. Okay.
That sounds better in a way.
Yeah, see, in many ways, you know. Yeah, it's.
I've never heard it put like that.
It's certainly easier to wrap your mind around, you know, having your horizontal penetration to completeness just encompassing a local universe, as opposed to what you're going to try to do as a finaliter, where you have to encompass all seven super universes like that.
I forget. Do they even go to the minor and major sectors?
In general, no. Right? They, you know, there's two legs to their finite career, just like those who go to the Isle of Paradise. You have an ascension leg, a first leg. You know, they ascend to Salvington. In our case, they ascend to the local universe headquarters. So you ascend to that local perfection, and then you penetrate horizontally to completion, relative to a local universe whole.
But you become a spirit being, right?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I mean, you know, they're a Mirantia being just like us, going, you know, right along with us all the way up.
To a spirit being, right? Do you know what I mean?
Well, yeah, I mean, eventually, you know, we're not going to all those details, but eventually they become, like the quote unquote spirit beings of a local universe. Yeah, it's just that they evolved into that state. So they have these two legs. It's just whether or not. You know, you are going to have that, you have the perfection first phase, and then you have the completion second phase. Is your completion going to be relative to, your completion is relative to which whole? Let me say it that way. You know, to which whole are you going to be complete? A local universe whole, a super universe whole, or, you know, the collective super universe, you know, wholeness.
So, do they have any awareness outside of the local universe in their completion?
No, I mean, in the same way that
they don't know what we know from the Urantia book, they don't know anything about.
Well, I mean, they know a lot of things, you know, but I mean,
they know there's ancient.
Yeah, I mean, they're not ignorant of what's beyond. It's just they don't embody it.
No, they don't.
Right, experientially.
So they do know of it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, you know, ever since, you know, as soon as you get to the first mansion world, you're going to be talking with beings from all over the place, right? You'll know all kinds of things, visitors from other local universes and whatnot. Right? You know, so you know, you're not, you know, parochial, you know, in your knowledge, but still, it's just in terms of what do you experientially embody, you know. It's not what you know, there's a difference between what you know about and what you know.
Yeah.
That you literally embody experientially. And so you've got, you know, the majority are just in that normal primitive mode, pre-planetary prince, you know, this primitive man. You know, in that primitive mode, and hence they're spirit fusers, with just, you know, the first pair being an exception and a few others, as they're pointing out. Obviously, Anagar is going to be a father fuser, but, you know, we just don't know, you know, who others. Other than Santa, you know, they mentioned Santa. The other thing to think about with this is, if you want to get a little technical about it, remember about the whole issue that's in play of getting an adjuster in the first place. Okay, like we've talked about, you've got the way of getting it, you know, kind of by default. If your parents have adjusters, right, then once you, you know, get to having all seven adjutants and getting encircled in the Holy Spirit, you can get an adjuster. But there's going to be, you know, that's going to get broken, you know. I mean, and so there's going to be individuals that that aren't getting an adjuster just because their parents have one. So then you have all of those complexities of the prerequisites for adjuster indwelling coming into play. But when you're talking about this mode where you have spirit fusers, I don't know if you remember, let's see, where is that? I can remind you where that is. That's in paper 108, section 2, prerequisites of adjuster indwelling. There's six different items that they give you there about how you can get one. And the sixth one is specifically about these spirit fusers, where when you're in a very primitive mode like that, there's so little that the individual can do, kind of just in and of themselves, to meet some prerequisite in getting an adjuster. Right? They're just very limited. And they're living such a short time, right? I mean, so that getting adjusters for those individuals is very much in the hands of the Supreme, or the Mother of total finite sense. And they mention that. They don't understand the physics of that at all either. I mean, they just, a lot of these individuals get adjusters so that they can at least have a soul, so that they can go on to the first mansion world. Yeah, they're not going to fuse with that adjuster. They're going to fuse with the spirit fragment of the creative mother spirit, but, you know, there's a soul. If you don't get an adjuster, there's no soul, and you don't survive. So there's, you know, there's all going to be lots of these individuals that, you know, if you had been there looking at them, it's like, well, I don't know, I don't see anything exceptional about this individual. I don't think they're going to, you know, they didn't get an adjuster automatically. I'll bet you this one doesn't survive. And then the next thing you know, an adjuster shows up, and they get a soul, and you and all of the celestials are scratching their heads. Don't look at me. I don't know. I mean, but sure enough, this individual got an adjuster, and so they have at least an embryonic soul, and they'll survive. But then others don't, right? And those that don't, I see, not only are the ones that do very much in the hands of the total finite and the mysteries of that total finite, but even those that don't, right? I mean, those that don't are just localized in space and time means for the Supreme to evolve, right? That's, you know, they're just like cells in the Supreme, you know, those that don't get an adjuster. You know, or if you like the old analogy, they're drops of water in the ocean, right? That is the Supreme. They appear to be separate, but they technically aren't. So there's all this mystery to that. Yeah.
Since we're thinking about how nowadays, right now, we're pretty primitive. And, I mean, the Ancient Book tells us, you know, even most Christians, or so-called Christians, are, they don't even realize they're not Christians, and they don't have that. So are we going back to more? We have to be. I mean,
even though in terms of civilization, in many ways we're pre-primitive, because of Pentecost, we aren't primitive, you know, or pre-primitive in this sense.
Get it right. Automatically.
Right.
If you go through the seven adjustments,
no matter how primitive you are in terms of using the human gifts that are given to you by grace, right, the Spirit of Truth is bridging the gap between that very lowly mindful fact and getting an adjuster. And, you know, technically between that lowly seventh circular fact, you know, very minimalistic seventh circular fact, and a third circular, right? This, the Spirit of Truth, functioning as a spirit of unification, bridges that gap, no matter how, right? I mean, there's no gap too great. As long as you're genuinely human, as long as you actually get all seven adjutants and get encircled in the Holy Spirit, yeah, and are seventh circular, right? Post-Pentecost, there's no issue.
And that can't change, can it?
And that can't change, yeah. That physics is irreversible. The Master Son is sovereign and established that fact, and that's that. Right? There's nothing we can do to fall out of that grace. Right? You don't have that kind of Old Testament sort of mode of, oh, I think we've fallen out of grace again, you know, or anything like that. That grace is an indelible given, but back here, right, this is way pre-Pentecost. You've got all these complexities of getting an adjuster. My guess is those that were father fusers all got them because their parents had adjusters. It's very unlikely that any of these individuals you know, even Onagar could achieve some, you know, other prerequisite, you know, one of those prerequisites just in and of yourself, you know, not dependent upon your parents, but just, you know, what you do bootstrapping, right, yourself. I mean, they're just so limited. I mean, for instance, think about one of the basic ones to get an adjuster. If you don't get one automatically, you got to get to third circler. Okay, I mean, none of these individuals got to third circler. You know, you may recall, you didn't. The first human to get to third circler during their mortal life here was a red man. Okay, and in terms of starting with Anna Infanta, we're 500,000 years away from the first red men. Right. So, you know, none of these pre-planetary prince Andonites got the third circler, you know, and for them to do some sort of a supreme equivalency sort of, you know, prerequisite, it's pretty unlikely. And so, most likely the only ones that were father fusers are the ones that were just getting them, you know, naturally because their parents had them and their parents all the way back to Anna Infanta. Okay. And then everyone else was, you know, was it, and even some of them that got adjuster automatically just were spirit fusers, but then, you know, if they didn't get an adjuster automatically, right, it would have had to have been one of these very just completely mysterious, by grace, this individual gets an adjuster, and no, and not even the revelators understand, you know, the individual, you know, it just doesn't seem to have anything to do with the individual at all, see, because it really doesn't, it has to do with the whole. The whole needs that individual to have an adjuster. It has nothing to do immediately with what they are in and of themselves at that point in time, right? Okay, so that's the, you see, that one little statement, it's just that one little statement because they want you to pause and really think about all these complexities that you learn of in other places in the book. I should maybe mention, let's see, if you're wondering about where... let's see. The whole bit about the red man, that's in paper 113, section 2, second paragraph there, where it says, in the evolution of races, a guardian of destiny is assigned to the very first being who attains the requisite circle of conquest. And I just told you in the previous paragraph, that's third circler. On Urantia, the first mortal to secure a personal guardian was Rontawak, a wise man of the red race of long ago. Yeah. And so you notice that wise man. You don't have much in the way of definitive quote-unquote wisdom happening in the Andonites yet. They're just too primitive.
So this doesn't include
Onagar. Like I said, see again... Onagar, remember how they mentioned how he's, you know, not that far removed from Anna Infantis, you know, so he would be in that pure line where, you know, a child gets it because parents got it, you know, and generation to generation, and he gets one because of that. Yes, he was an exceptional individual, but he didn't bootstrap himself to getting an adjuster, extremely unlikely, even Onagar. Yeah.
I would have thought that he did because he was the first person with the... And it didn't matter that he was first, but he actually was expressing truth.
Yes, see, but again, there's a big difference between a beginning relationship to genuine truth and a third circler. Right? You know, you got to remember. I mean, a seventh circler is supposed to have, you know, at least Onagar-like relationship to truth. You know, and the sad to record is. Right, you know, why this book is in my lap is because, right, I mean, our seven circlers, yeah, okay, by grace you become a seven circler, but you're not availing yourself of anything. You know not the truth, right? Civilization's collapsing because of it, etc. So, again, see, when all is said and done, you kind of appreciate why I stressed right up front when they introduced Anna Infanta and getting their adjusters, how important it is that they're a cut above, so they can definitely handle being a father fuser, and can definitively start out these lines of spiritual descent, if you will, right, where children get adjusted because parents had them, you know. So people like Anagar can definitely have one to help bring what they have genetically to a better focus, and they can be a very significant, influential truth teacher, etc. Oblivious to the fact they have an adjuster and everything, but nonetheless, right? Super consciously, it's juicing them up. All of the three cosmic intuitions just work better. They're more tangible. They're better focused. When you have an adjuster.
So one wonders if the experiment that the lab carriers were trying to get, you know, by creating will come sooner, also was trying to, you know, create a being that would be able to have adjusters prior to a colored race, saying a grace, and didn't quite pan out that way.
Yeah, interesting. Yeah, I mean, obviously I'm speculating quite a bit here. You know, there may be some exceptions that they just don't mention. Maybe there were some really exemplary individuals that kind of, where the life carriers went, oh, look at there. Okay. We were wondering if maybe that could happen. Maybe someone did really definitively bootstrap themselves.
But on the whole.
Yeah, yeah. But, you know, you have some definite data points. I mean, you know, there isn't another member of the 420 counselors from the Andonites prior to the Planetary Prince. You know that. And you also know there weren't any third circlers until the Sangiks.
No, that's what I mean.
Yeah, so, you know, it just, yeah. you know, and it's not because the Andonites couldn't live long enough, you know, like the Sangiks could, like we see. I mean, their longevity is 75 years, so... theoretically, they could have, but just most likely they're just too limited. All right, let's get another chunk here.
Andon and Fanta, shortly after their arrival on Gerasim, received permission from the system sovereign to return to the first mansion world to serve with the Marantia personalities who welcomed the pilgrims of time from Urantia to the heavenly spheres. And they have been assigned indefinitely to this service. They sought to send greetings to Urantia in connection with these revelations. But this request was wisely denied them.
Okay, so now let's deal with that last one first. It's like, okay, now wait a minute. That is actually directly what they're talking about up there in that passage I read about no communications during, you know, a current dispensation. It's like, well, we're several dispensations from theirs. Okay, so why not? Why was it so unwise to deny them that? You notice you get the impression that the question has been asked many times over the last million years. Or last 500,000 years, I guess I should say. Last 500,000 years. You know, can we go to your ranch? No. Can we communicate? No. Oh, come on.
It's funny.
A little footnote on a postcard? Come on. Anything?
But the funny part is that by saying that, they sent greetings.
Yes, mm-hmm. Yes, of course. Yeah, just not directly. Indirectly, we got the greeting, but... but see, that just adds to it. It's like, well, why was it wisely denied? See, that just adds to the mystery. I mean, it's not, you know, if it was unwise to even tell us that you could sort of request this, I mean, they wouldn't have mentioned that.
How would it come to us, the greeting from them?
They would have put it in the book.
Oh,
yeah, they would have just, you know, and here's the greeting, the end of Infanta. Yeah, they would just literally, you know.
But that would be the only way the greeting would come.
Yeah. They would have put it in the book, you know, just like they put, you know, you remember how occasionally they put some things, you know, in the book, you know, from different beings. Yeah, we read archangel messages and, you know, They stick some messages in here. So if they'll stick those other messages in here, why won't they stick Anna Infantis?
So they would have been.
What?
What was that?
It says right there, in connection with these revelations, they wanted to send greetings.
Yeah, yeah.
Which means they would have got a paragraph or a paper.
Yeah.
I'm sure it has to do not with Anna Infantis, but our limitedness and our immaturity to put that in perspective if we were to try to.
Yeah. Right. I mean, obviously, the reason it's wise is it somehow would be upsetting to us. And it's like, well, okay, you told us about master architects, which normally a local universe has to be settled in light and life before you tell anyone about them, but you won't tell us what Andon and Font that, you know, that they said hi and put it in quotes.
They don't reveal a lot of the real clues.
Anyway, I'm just trying to get the juices flowing. See, just notice how much potential speculation you can do there. Anyway, it's a funny little thing, but it's definitely, it's not just because, so if you're up there and you're going and you're waiting, okay, there's the next dispensation. Okay, now can I send a message? They might still say no. So from that other passage, don't think, that if you just stand there and wait in line, until the next dispensation, finally you can send a message. I mean, the obvious thing about that not during a current dispensation is, basically everyone that you know or even are closely related to, right, will all be on the mansion worlds with you. And so you're going to send it back to whom?
Right.
Right. Obviously, you're wanting to send it back to someone you know, right? I mean, they're all in the mansion worlds with you. Right?
Just like they're going to be here in a few minutes. Right.
So that all makes sense. It's this passage that throws in another little twist, see, to that statement up there. It's not just that simplicity of a current dispensation and the people that you're immediately connected to down here. There's other issues in play. Yeah.
So.
Yeah. No, well, there's a good thought. See, now that's.
So they are connected to all of us.
Yeah.
Unlike anyone else.
Yeah. Yeah. That's a great thought. See, we could run with that speculation.
And that can hold a lot of sway. And so instead of, people could start, putting them on a pedestal worshiping the concept or whatever imaginary things they're putting around it, and it could become a serious ism.
Yeah, I mean, like I pointed out, the way they coined the names Anna and Fanta, they're sort of just alternatives for the Hebrew words Adam and Eve. And so it would be, here's a message from the real, quote-unquote, Adam and Eve, in your Old Testament, the real first two humans. So maybe it does just, bring up way too much sort of affirmation of stuff like that and tendency to worship, aggrandize, It would feed into those who still are wanting to do ancestor worship. Yeah, it would definitely play into that. All right, let's see what else we have there. All right, so then the rest of it there. So Anaphon, shortly after their arrival on Gerizim, that bit about receiving permission from the system sovereign to return to the first mansion world. So we've already mentioned this a couple times. They'll be there to greet you, along with these. Remember, there's all these Marantia personalities that they don't reveal that they're referring to there in passing again. They'll be part of your welcoming party when you wake up in the resurrection halls on the first mansion world.
Really think they can greet billions and billions of people?
They have all the time in the world.
Beyond the world.
Yep. It's also like everyone getting a little personal acknowledgement from Michael and Abaddon when you're leaving the local universe. you think this receiving line would be long? What about that one?
Of course, we'll recognize them because they'll be wearing animal skins.
Yes.
Right. Yeah.
We'll be wearing the skins.
I just remembered. I knew there was something dangling as we went to this paragraph. We had so much discussion on that previous little paragraph. The other little tidbit that I mentioned a few sessions back, on Gerasim, both Ann and Infanta were fused with their thought adjusters. Mm-hmm. Sorry, I didn't mention that in context. But that little loose end, see, there it is. So you've got that additional element of, you know, kind of the norm, sort of, if you will, is fusing, say, in about the fifth mansion world. But again, you can't help but wonder, well, I guess, you know, because of their more primitive nature, did it take longer? And so they didn't actually fuse until they were actually Gerasim citizens. And again, those things we don't understand there, does any of that play into them not sending greetings or not being allowed to visit? I mean, you always wonder, you know, this bit about them, you know, being not permitted. Nothing is arbitrary. So is there some sort of like literal physics thing involved somehow that we don't even remotely understand to these, you know, being denied permission? I mean, I don't know. I mean, is it some sort of a injection of an actual sort of energy into the system from their perspective that's not appropriate? I don't know. Anyway, you had a thought?
Yeah. So our thought adjusters choose us based on, you know, best fit for what's needed in eternity.
Mm-hmm.
And they identify, you know, circumstances and things with eternity in mind are guiding the entire path. And so because we don't know what the eternity piece is, you know, what mm-hmm. the goal point is, you know, that's going to be steering all sorts of things that we just won't understand. I mean, you can go back to some very primitive person who just was perfect or something, and even if we couldn't, you know, no one could figure out, well, what the heck are they choosing that one for, or why did this happen to this one at this time, and why is this one fusing this way or that way, or why is they're not, you know, doing certain things, or why is this one happening early? I mean, I think that if I was a betting person, I would say that it's probably just, you know, the eternity piece of the thing that's making the difference. You know, identified with that one because that one is what it means.
Yeah, I mean, that I was going to kind of get to that, sort of just coming back around with, you know, where you can't help but notice is, but this request was wisely denied them. Right? I mean, that's telling you that it's something to do with the whole, by using the word wisely. You know, that's why I was bringing in that very, you know, cryptic comments about, you know, there's these subtleties to the whole that are inscrutable to, you know, in general, most of the revelators even. You know, the subtlest little change, you know, is magnified, you know, into this gigantic fact within the whole, you know, because there's a whole, right? I mean, it's not just a collection of parts. So, you know, I can't help but wonder if you really had some high perspective, if you could literally see kind of the physics of this, of, you know, even if they seem to, even if they told you something that seems completely innocuous, right, in this greeting, right, is it like, you know, we kind of begin to play with these thoughts of, you know, a butterfly flaps its wings on the other side of the planet, you know, and because it's a nonlinear system, it leads to a hurricane on the, you know, on the other side of the planet, on this side of the planet, you know. You know, that sort of butterfly effect concept. I mean, you know, when you're dealing with the whole of the finite, right, it's hugely nonlinear, right? And, you know, it isn't just, well, it's a small thing, so it has small consequences. You know, you're thinking arithmetically. You can't think that way. You have to think geometrically about it. And so I can't help but think that there might be some, you know, very, I mean, even those that are immediately denying them the request may not understand, but, you know, there's sort of a, you know, something that comes from even higher up, you know, that those who have the very, very big picture sense. So I don't know. Anyway, I mean, there's all these sorts of inscrutable things that go on all over in the book of the whole. I mean, why do, you know, why do personalized adjusters appear this time when the Most High Observer assumes a regency and not that time? And, you know, all these mysterious things that no one understands the physics of. But anyway, yeah, so you've got you know, you've got this, you know, this issue that they are a differential from kind of the norm, you know, and is that significant? That's why I was, you know, I was remembering. Oops, I forgot to talk about the fact that they fused on Gerasim because I wanted to bring up that point. Is there anything to do with the fact, just that differential? Maybe that has something to do with it. I don't know. Anyway, okay, so, and you notice it's not just them too, you know, but everyone was having to get to Gerasim there. You see, and also several of their children, including Santet. So it's a general issue that they are kind of a differential from the norm.
Well, since we went on so long about this, mm-hmm. Katie made it to a bumper sticker. It's probably just the eternity thing that's making the difference.
All right. Okay, let's finish it up here.
And this is the recital of the most heroic and fascinating chapter in all the history of Urantia, the story of the evolution, life, struggles, death, and eternal survival of the unique parents of all mankind, presented by a life carrier resident on Urantia.
And just, okay, so they set that paragraph apart, you know, with a big break. And it's another rather dramatic statement. I mean, the most heroic and fascinating chapter. That's a pretty strong statement. It's like, well, what about the life of Jesus? See, you know, I mean, that's a, you know, have you ever paused on that sentence? Like, wow, that's a pretty superlative sentence.
Jesus had a school he could go to and learn.
Yeah. They had nobody but themselves to begin with, yes. Talk about bootstrapping yourself.
So why aren't there movies about this then?
Yeah.
There could be in the future.
In the future, there'll be lots of grand movies based upon the history in the Urantia book.
I mean, this has got all the elements to a good movie.
Yeah.
Why not?
Improved
plan of the cave bear.
And it just adds again to, so they have this incredible experience, right? It's the most heroic and fascinating chapter. But what are they doing in the previous paragraph? They're indefinitely assigned on the first mansion world as greeters. So just look at the humility there. Right? And, you know, Has this gone to their head? That they are the most heroic and fascinating chapter in all of the history of your ranch, huh? No. First shall be last, last shall be first.
And that eased the tension about being refused the greeting thing. Oh, look at that accolade.
I get to greet everybody. Yeah.
Pretty sweet.
I think it must be a joyous thing for them to greet, and they don't want to give it up.
Yeah. And the indefinitely thing, you know, they say that. I mean, that probably means until you're no longer using the mansion worlds, right, you know, anymore. That would be quote-unquote indefinitely.
When would that be? What do you mean?
Well, once there's no more, you know, primitive enough worlds, you know, early enough worlds in this local system where the mortals have to go to the mansion worlds. You know, everyone is starting on Gerasim or higher, you know. Then they roll up the sidewalks on the mansion worlds and use them for something else.
No, no,
another
rubber stick.
Write it
down.
And then there's that, you know, we talked about this when with the 4 and 20 counselors. You know, you've got all these individuals that literally have fused with their adjusters, and yet they're doing a very long-term horizontal surface. You know, they're not being inexorably drawn up in the first phase of their finite career, you know, that the ascension phase. We've always kind of, you know, puzzled over that, you know. How do you kind of put that ascension thing in suspended animation, if you will, indefinitely? I don't know the answer to that. Because otherwise it seems like it's this pretty inexorable thing. You know, you just ascend, you're chugging upward. And you don't do the horizontal thing until you're resident of paradise.
If you're a celestial artisan, you have to sign up for a minimum of 1,000,000 years, isn't it?
There's some huge number.
A lot of years. So.
That's short, you know, compared to indefinitely, right?
Yeah.
So, there's that little mystery between the lines there, too.
Worlds haven't been started yet. They're in for a long tour of duty.
Yeah, right. We're just talking about this local system, but still, right, we've got, two more chunks of 200 worlds to go, and that's a lot of years. So
we could have harvested greeters from any of them. No.
Well, also, they got that between the lines. This is going to be greeters for the other worlds, too, apparently, too.
Yeah.
And then you're wondering, are they the first mortals from each of those worlds? They're all the first mortals from all the different, you know, all 619 worlds right now in the local system? I mean, are there...
No way.
Yeah.
But they could be the first ones that were not a colored race.
Again, there's just another big question mark there. It's like, oh, well, what about all them? You know, who besides Anna and Infanto will be there that you can meet too? On a normal world, right? I mean, if it's the first two humans, they would be, you know, former red men. That's the typical thing. But anyway, there's a million things they don't tell you. So they end with that little bit of a poetic flourish of that, you know, you should just strive to go beyond the simple factual nature of what we've just been reading and appreciate that there is a grand truth there, right, that makes it the most heroic and fascinating chapter in all the history of Urantia. Yeah, and so one day, you know, maybe we'll appreciate more why it's appropriate for the life carrier to say that. Right now it seems kind of strange. It's like, because like I said, I mean, the first thing you think of is like, well, wait a minute, of all human knowledge, that which is of greatest value is to know the religious life of Jesus and how he lived it. I mean, doesn't that get number one billing? Not according to this sentence. So in what, you know, exactly how am I supposed to interpret that sentence? It's kind of a mysterious sentence. All right. Okay, so now let's move on here. Spent an hour on what? One, two, three, four little paragraphs. but they're very consequential little paragraphs there.
Worth savoring.
Yep, they're worth savoring. Like I said, there was no way I was going to do them such disservice to cram them into the end of the preceding session. We needed time to let those paragraphs breathe. Pardon the pun with the breath giver. Yep.
So when we leave here, we go to a mansion world of some kind.
Yep, we go.
And then there's also a resurrection, which might take up to 500,000 years.
Well, not with us.
Oh.
Yeah.
Okay.
With us, it'll be a lot shorter time. But you know, you right, you die here.
Mm-hmm.
Your guardian angels take possession of your soul. And that's effectively the brain for your next body. They take it to the first mansion world, and in due time, whenever that is for each of us, they build a body for that. They put that brain in it, if you will, that your soul into it, as the center and seat for your mind for that new body. Your adjuster comes back and plugs into you, if you will, and you awaken. Yeah, that's your resurrection.
Hmm.
So it's you see, again, technically what you're doing, I mean, is recognize it's not my body that's going to get resurrected. I have two basic aspects to me right now. I have a material aspect and a mindal aspect. And it's not my material aspect. It's not my body that's resurrected. It's my mind. Your soul is basically the framework for your mind so that mind can be resurrected. But it's not your lowly animal origin mind, it's your better mind, it's your higher mind that it's the soul is the framework for. You know, so your better mind is resurrected. Not the mind that is worried about hangnails and whatnot. Not that lowly mind. It's a way of taking what's now pretty abstract, that idea of resurrecting my mind. It's like, well, that seems pretty intangible. The soul, they're telling you this soul is not another name for your mind. They're going to use the word soul for this literal object that's the framework for your mind, your higher mind. That survives. No ashes to ashes, dust for to dust for it. And it's given a new body, and it's reanimated, and off you go.
And your new body will reflect kind of where you're at.
Yeah.
So we're not going to be like...
so lumping like we are now.
Brilliant.
Yeah.
Some people think that we are going to be just brilliant beings from the back.
Yeah. All right. So... so now, like I said, we're ready to kind of get back in this chronological mode, and they want to step us more methodically through the evolution of humans, and give us a number of points of relationship to the facts that we've discovered so far, so that we can from a more scientific perspective, we can start to put together what we've unearthed with the hints that the revelators are giving us. All right, let's get going here.
Paper 64, The Evolutionary Races of Color. This is the story of the evolutionary races of Urantia from the days of Andon and Fanta, almost 1 million years ago, down through the times of the Planetary Prince to the end of the Ice Age.
Why don't you go ahead and read that other paragraph too?
The human race is almost 1 million years old. And the first half of its story roughly corresponds to the pre-Planetary Prince days of Urantia. The latter half of the history of mankind begins at the time of the arrival of the Planetary Prince and the appearance of the six colored races, and roughly corresponds to the period commonly regarded as the Old Stone Age.
Okay. So just that little preface. However, already in just that little preface, they are they're guiding the scientists to a more productive approach to delineating the different phases of human history. They're reminding you that you've got a million years, but it very much is two halves. Right? That things are going to be much more definitively human for the most recent 500,000 years, the second half, than the first. And they're saying the Old Stone Age, you know, or the Paleolithic, right, if you prefer to use that term, don't have that go back indefinitely. Have it go back just to 500,000 years ago. Have the beginning of the Paleolithic be 500,000 years ago, the Old Stone Age. And you need an additional term to talk about the prior times. What you need, technically, is the Eolithic. In contrast to the Paleolithic, the Eolithic is not a term that's very much used, but the Revelators are saying you really need to use that term for the Dawn Stone Age. So for instance, the latter part of that Dawn Stone Age would be from a million years ago to 500,000 years ago. Right? That's going to be a mode of stone tools, that is pre-Paleolithic. It's less, less sophisticated, more primitive, right? And is worthy of a distinction. Plus, you actually have, the Eolithic is going to go back even further than a million years ago, because you have those pre-human and subhuman species that were sophisticated enough to be doing crude stone tools, before you had humans. Okay, so it seems like a minor point, but the scientists are very confused about all this stuff, because there's all of this complexity, like they eventually tell us. There are, around 7,000 different strains, in play, intermixing in all kinds of different ways. It's super complicated, and we have very crude ways of calling something human, and so we see a stone tool, and we have a tendency to say human, and it's like, well, okay, I mean, technically, you don't have definitive human stone tools really until 500,000 years ago, and it's kind of just precursor stuff before that. But immediately before that, there's going to be some little bit more sophisticated stone tools side by side with much less sophisticated ones from the subhuman species. And okay, it's all this complexity.
What's paleo meaning?
Oh, in this kind of case, old.
Old.
See, Paleolithic is old stone age. This is literally what it means. And Eolithic is dawn stone age. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you can interpret the prefix paleo in different modes, but when you're doing it in the where the root is lithic, it just means old. Neolithic is the new stone age.
Right? So what's the next lithic you mentioned?
So
Eolithic. What does that mean?
Dawn. Stone age.
Is it
E? E-O.
Just E-O?
Yeah, just Eolithic. Okay. Like the Eocene. Yeah, remember we used that E-O prefix before with the Eocene. But we didn't interpret it as dawn there. You have to interpret those prefixes relative to the context that you're using them in. And you'll see when we read a little bit, the Revelators bring in the dawn interpretation. Okay, so that's the first thing that they're giving you is that clean little line of beginning the Paleolithic at 500,000 years ago. And going, so bringing in post-primitive humans. All right. So let's, so you can see they're going to kind of sort of take us back to the beginning of a million years ago and step us forward.
Number one, the Adonic Aborigines. Primitive man made his evolutionary appearance on Earth a little less than 1 million years ago, and he had a vigorous experience. He instinctively sought to escape the danger of mingling with the inferior simian tribes. But he could not migrate eastward because of the arid Tibetan land elevations, 30,000 feet above sea level. Neither could he go south nor west because of the expanded Mediterranean Sea, which then extended eastward to the Indian Ocean. And as he went north, he encountered the advancing ice. But even when further migration was blocked by the ice, and though the dispersing tribes became increasingly hostile, the more intelligent groups never entertained the idea of going southward to live among their hairy tree-dwelling cousins of inferior intellect.
Okay. So interesting what they're going to stress yet again. This whole issue that's going to plague mankind for a long time, the backmating issue. That's a huge part of for the scientists to consider in trying to understand what the heck they're looking at when they dig up fossils, humans, or pre-humans. There's no concept of that currently in attempts to rationalize the data. That you have very definitive humans. See, with the more intelligent groups never entertain the idea. Okay. Once you get to Sangiks, that's very solid. That they're not entertaining the idea of backmating. But here in these pre-Sangiks, you've got a spectrum. But the more intelligent ones, you're kind of Sangik-like and never entertain the idea of backmating. So again, it shows you how definitive Annan and Fanta started out mankind. And then they're giving you a little bit of the geography again. We've mentioned, you've got a much expanded Mediterranean Sea, both northward, southward, and eastward from what it is now, including, like they're saying, it extends all the way down to the Indian Ocean. Okay, that whole swath was underwater. And so you're blocked that direction by water, the Tibetan Highlands to the west and the ice to the north, and you don't want to go south because, there's hairy, tree-dwelling cousins of inferior intellect down there. And notice they also stressed the Harry again, like I've done a number of times. I mean, the degree to which you have humans now that have more hair than others, and that's because of the back mating that brought in the greater hair. In general, people that are quite definitively sanguic don't have a lot of body hair, right? But you get the Europeans, right? As we'll read this story, where we see there's a number of a lot of back mating stocks that are being blended in there. You can get a lot of body hair again.
But the more intelligent didn't go south; the less intelligent did.
Yeah, as we'll see, right? As the time goes on and they start to migrate, the less intelligent do go south, and there's lots and lots of back mating. Yeah. And they don't stay south. They go north again and cause problems. And yeah, so that's what we're going to read here. Okay, let's see. Anything else? Oh, yeah, they had a vigorous experience. So again, they're stressing that. Just notice what little things they're stressing. That it's important to, they're going to mention this again here, to have this... basically cattle prod, right? It's external cattle prod poking us, motivating us, if you will, right? Prodding us forward. So that we, there's, especially when you're a primitive human, there's a limit to how much, you can pull yourself up by your bootstraps. There's a limit to how much you can kind of get yourself going. You got to be poked from the outside. The more you move into advancing civilization, the more you have that drive within to progress. But in the, for the first half of progressing civilization, the early phase, you need various cattle prods like slavery, war, social classes, profit motive, right? Or literally prickly environment. Okay. Okay, so they're trying to give you all of these basic elements that if you don't keep in mind all the time, you'll go off on false interpretive tangents with the data. Okay. All right, keep going here.
Many of man's earliest religious emotions grew out of his feeling of helplessness in the shut-in environment of this geographic situation. Mountains to the right, water to the left, and ice in front. But these progressive Andonites would not turn back to their inferior tree-dwelling relatives in the south.
Okay, so...
same thing in America.
Yep,
so, mentioned we're trying to avoid those people
in the south. Yeah, so you notice again, okay, that so they basically said what they've said already, but they added a little twist. They emphasize progressive, like I was just saying, this whole bit of progressing civilization. Okay, so what causes mankind to progress? Where's the potential that is actualized as progressing mind? Progressibility is a potential in what?
Spirit.
Right? And our relationship to that third energy, spirit, that has the potential of progressibility in it. It's getting actualized as progressing mind, down from spirit down to mind. All right, so you have a spiritual nature that naturally produces a progressing mind and a progressing civilization, right? That's the external expression of those progressing minds. But look at, they're bringing in this religious tension. They're trapped. Okay, you have you want to progress very, very fundamentally. You desire to progress, but you're still quite primitive. It's too abstract to just think about. Well, I'm just going to let my mind progress. Now you want to move your feet, right? To demonstrate that progressing nature, but you can't. Right? You're shut in. Right? Mountains to the right, water to the left, ice in front, and
stuck in the middle.
Right?
But in reality, it's quite a bit of distance there, right? I mean, it's not just like.
Well, no, it's not 5 square feet, right? You know, yes, but yeah, they're not that shut in. But they are pointing out that geographic limitation, yeah, even though it's not room sized, right? That gets reflected into your mind, and you've got this very trapped feeling inside, you know, in between your ears, that is going to be a fundamental engine for your initial crude theologies, right, of your religion. You know, your religion is going to have a lot to do with God free me from my, you know, imprisonment here, my shut-in environment, my sense of being trapped. Okay, and so anything you can think of in religions that exist today that kind of reflect that desire for God to liberate, you know, from your captivity, see, the 10 goes all the way back to the Andonites in that initial geographic locale, getting that kind of a theology going, and on it goes, like we've seen so many times.
Well, we have in our Old Testament experience the Hebrews who were trapped in Egypt, and that's a big part of their...
Right. See, you're getting, you're picking it up. See, you see when I say that, and your gears start turning, it's like, oh yeah, like being trapped in Egypt and God liberating you from that, you know, that geographic and, you know, confinement and all that sort of mentality. That's what's between the lines there. You know, that one little paragraph. See, it's just, they're opening a doorway for all kinds of recognition. You can go back and think about what's in the Old Testament, what's in other, you know, ancient elements of other religions. And does it go all the way back to those poor Andonites trapped, you know, by water and mountains and ice?
We're kind of trapped in a failing civilization.
Yeah.
I mean, there's not much we can do unless you want to go to a cave, which I can't afford to do that anyway. So we're trapped also.
But I gave you the hint already, see. You want to challenge yourself to be less material-minded. I mean, yes, you may be physically confined, but your mind is not.
Yeah, I know.
Right?
That's the exciting thing about
Don't limit yourself like that, right? Remember that you're not just a blob of protoplasm. Don't make your religion all about the material and the temporal, because then it's not actually religion. It's not genuinely religion, right? But these poor primitive people, right, they couldn't think that abstractly. And so,
count to three.
Right, they couldn't even count to three, right? Right, so, yeah. But the challenge is still there. Don't base your religion on the material and the temporal. See, you gotta see these religious emotions, you know, so that it's just your emotions about the environment, and then you're exalting that into a quote-unquote religion. Okay. How does this environment make me feel? Well, that's my whole rationalization scheme for my religion and God's relationship to me. Right? That's all just an anthropomorphic God, see.
So we become untrapped, though, sitting here, we can do it.
You shall know the truth, and the truth shall set you free.
Yeah.
See? But we were talking about how difficult it was for these ancient Andonites to know the truth, see? But see, so Jesus was, see, he was speaking to this same thing, right? If you can find the truth, it doesn't matter if you're literally in a prison cell, you won't feel imprisoned.
Right?
Because, like I was saying earlier, after all, what's resurrected? The body that's imprisoned or the mind that never was? Right? Trying to challenge us. Right? Think about yourself. You know, the real you is a mind, not a body.
Well,
you want to focus on that. A self is a mind, not a body. A self has a body. Right?
Which you have to.
Right. Well, yourself is seated, right? Your mind is seated on the body. Yes, right. There's all those issues, but right, just you know, flip it around. Okay, so that's there's always something big between the lines of these. It's relevant to you here and now. Okay, keep going.
These Andonites avoided the forests in contrast with the habits of their non-human relatives. In the forest, man has always deteriorated. Human evolution has made progress only in the open and in the higher latitudes. The cold and hunger of the open lands stimulate action, invention, and resourcefulness. While these Andonic tribes were developing the pioneers of the present human race amidst the hardships and privations of these rugged northern climes, their backward cousins were luxuriating in the southern tropical forests of the land of their early common origin.
Okay, so which is your natural animal origin nature tend to? Hardships and privations or luxuriating?
The pina coladas.
Right, the pina coladas, right?
Have you seen the South lately?
So remember what they say about, you know, when a people gets more advanced, they use their free time better? See, as soon as we get a little free time, do we go to domains of hardships and privations, or do we go to luxuriating, salubrious climes?
Well, but that's the difference, because we live in those colder,
Right, but see, again...
So every now and then it's good to have a little bit of difference.
Right, so, well, that's the way we rationalize it to ourselves. That every once in a while it's good to have, you know. But just notice, right, I mean...
Jesus,
it's like yes, there is a truth there, but they're giving you a little challenge not to overplay that, right? And fundamentally, why don't you want to overplay it? Because what you want to be striving for, right? Like I said, you think of yourself more as a mind than as a body, right? And as a mind, you want to have courageous and independent cosmic thinking. Okay.
Chris, it takes. That would be north, because it's just as much cold way further south.
Well, yeah, but we're in the northern hemisphere here. You know? Okay, now you're going away from the equator, which is north in the northern hemisphere. We'll see that. You know, it's a long time before much in the way of the southern hemisphere comes into play. So, okay, but to the point here, it's just that. See, it takes courage. See, you notice they're stressing this again. Like I said, I mean, didn't they already tell us about this whole bit of the vigorous experiences? Like, why are they repeating it? Because you need an environment where perforce it requires courage, right? To stimulate getting to courageous and independent cosmic thinking, right? Those salubrious climbs lower your consciousness away from the upper domain of courageous and independent cosmic thinking, and you're just down there, right, in the lower domain of the hourglass analogy of your mind.
It seems like it's still the case that south is more...
And see, not only the north-south thing, but see, you know, notice they're setting that aside to a degree too, right? He has made progress only in the open and the higher latitudes. Not just the higher latitudes, he says, not just north, but see the cold and hunger of the open lands.
You need to live in the middle of North Dakota.
Right. They're putting forward that challenge that there isn't cold and hungry open lands is a sign of our fall from grace, right? Why isn't it all like the Garden of Eden, Well, because we fell from grace. And so there's North Dakota in the winter. Right? There's tundra. No, that's not why. Right? It is grace. It doesn't represent the fall from grace. Right? The open lands stimulate action, invention, and resourcefulness. They are the grace of God made geography and climate. Right? They're for your betterment. It's tough love.
It's kind of like the advice Jesus gave to the man who was afraid, right?
Yep. Right, get out there and, yeah.
Right. But look again, your mind is clear and capable. Use your strong body and your intelligent mind to direct it. Right? I find I give that advice to people all the time. Who get, you know, woe is me, what am I going to do? Well, figure, you know, use your mind, figure it out.
Yep.
Get up there and do something.
Yep. Yeah. And you know, there's nothing that stimulates like that, like necessity, right? You know, privations. What does privations mean? It means you're deprived of necessities, right? They don't come automatically, right? You've got to use your resourcefulness and invention and action to right, overcome those privations. Yeah, so... It's the earliest theme, and it's still the theme. And just remember that the whole point is eventually you're going to mature to the point where you can provide the attention internally. It doesn't have to be so crudely applied to you externally. But the degree to which you would like the prickly environment to go away, you know, in the age of light and life, right? You have to internalize that, right? You're not heading towards, you know, a bliss with no voltage, right? The voltage is external right now. You have to internalize that.
The universe career is a struggle.
Right. Pain and suffering are essential to progressive evolution. In other words, the tension, the differential.
Yeah. Well, part of this harsh environment is overpopulation. And the conflict that throws everybody into against one another.
Yeah, and so you say overpopulation is bad. Is it? It provides difficulties that require action, invention, and resourcefulness. Right. See, again, you know, usually we call something bad because I don't like the way it makes me feel, therefore it's bad. Are you sure? That's the definition of bad?
It's going to force us to do some kind of racial thing at some point, pretty not too far down the road.
Yeah, if we keep reading, we'll actually get to that here in just a minute. But anyway, so you get the point. You can see there's a large paragraph break there. I mean, they're making this very opening statement that I'm stressing here. All right. Yes, now we're going to kind of get into the story here a little more.
These events occurred during the times of the third glacier, the first according to the reckoning of the geologists. The first two glaciers were not extensive in northern Europe.
Just a little footnote there is... from the time they were giving us this text for the next, like, 20 years, over the next 20 years, the geologists there, you know, our human geologists did begin to get a rough sense that there were two prior glacial advances. Okay. But still today, even, the four are the main emphasis. And... if the other two are mentioned, they're a footnote. And so, much of this is still in play. But it is the case that that those prior two, the second one was, at the time of the writing of the Revelation, was just, you know, beginning to be recognized in some areas. And then, and by the time the book was published, the first one, you know, was beginning to be recognized. So that's how that synchronizes with what we, you know, with the knowledge we have today. Okay, but yeah, you know, so but that's, you know, going, well, haven't they told me about the third glacier thing several times? See, I'm saying the important point is now them mentioning, you want to really think about how it matches up with what the knowledge we have now. And seeing, oh yeah, they added that little piece there, see? That's the point of what we're reading now, is really thinking about synchronizing with the knowledge we have, trying to get better interpretations of the data that we have than the current interpretations, because they're very muddled.
During most of the Ice Age, England was connected by land with France, while later on, Africa was joined to Europe by the Sicilian land bridge. At the time of the Andonic migrations, there was a continuous land path from England in the west on through Europe and Asia to Java in the east. But Australia was again isolated, which further accentuated the development of its own peculiar fauna.
Okay, so they're pointing out you know, what we find fossil-wise is geographically in play. You know, to a high degree, a particular strain of humans can spread far and wide, you know, across all of Europe and Asia. If you don't know already, you'll see in a second why they mentioned Java there, if that strikes you as odd. Why that particular island in Indonesia is getting mentioned. Stressing that bit of... it's eventually, the gap gets bridged, but even though the oceans are down because there's ice, and so, you know, there's a lot more land in Southeast Asia than there is, you know, currently, you still have Australia, you know, having a water divide. So it took humans a while to actually get to Australia. Okay, so there's the first 50,000 years. You can see as you glance down, we're going to be taking 50,000 year steps here. So we should have about enough time here to get the remainder of this section here.
950,000 years ago, the descendants of Andon and Fauna had migrated far to the east and to the west. To the west, they passed over Europe to France and England. In later times, they penetrated eastward as far as Java, where their bones were so recently found, the so-called Java Man, and then journeyed on to Tasmania.
Okay, so at the end there, see, okay, eventually, right, they do make it all the way in Australia, even all the way down to Tasmania. Okay, but here's our first definitive statement to synchronize the fossil record we have with what they're talking about. Right at the end of the 19th century, as they're saying there, so recently found, the first what eventually, you know, and is now called Homo erectus fossil was found, Java Man. And right around the time they were putting the revelation together, another one that you've probably heard of was being discovered, Peking Man. And eventually those came to be collectively called Homo erectus, along with a whole bunch of other fossils that have been found. So I've already mentioned this. Essentially what we're talking about in terms of relating the revelation to paleontology, you know, or archaeology, if you will, is the Andonites are Homo erectus. Now, as they're about to mention, there's a huge complication with that, because there's all of this backmating in all kinds of different ways over 500,000 years. So it's super complicated. So you're going to have some very backmated, quote-unquote, Homo erectus, including as you're about to see, or you can speculate on, there's probably a fair amount of back mating, even with Java Man. Don't think of, oh, I'm going to go look and see what, you know, the Wikipedia says about the shape of the skull of Java Man, and I'm going to know what Annan and Fonda looked like. No, no, you can't do that. Okay? This is clear over in Java. And as they're about to mention, there's lots of back mating issues as you head east and south. Okay? So, yeah, in all these, I mean, in general, you can think of the Andonites as Homo erectus. You know, but you're going to need lots and lots of subspecies, you know, to that species erectus. You're going to call them Homo, and that's appropriate because we know amongst us are the genuine, pretty solid descendants of Annan and Fonta. Okay, they're human. Okay. And they're erect. You know, so that's all, you know, works well to just use that scientific term, you know, for the Andonites, Homo erectus. But you're gonna want to appreciate that there's going to be a number of things that the scientists call Homo erectus that are much older than a million years ago. Because there's all of these, you know, subhuman strains, you know, that were around long before Andan and Fonta, that were quite similar, biologically compatible, okay? You know, you would be looking for something without obvious signs of getting too simian-like, too ape-like, too robust, you know, most likely. If you were looking for something that was a minimally back-mated or a totally not back-mated Andanite, but if it starts to get more and more robust, you know, it's pretty likely that it's, you know, a back-mated individual that you've found the fossil remains of. But anyway, yeah, in a general sense, you now have them synchronized. Okay, so when we're talking about Homo erectus scientifically, we're talking about the Andonites and all those biologically compatible near-human species. Before, during, and after Andan and Fonta. All right. So that's for them to just throw in that little parenthetical, the so-called Java Man, that's huge. See, that gives you that whole linkage. Okay. Even the scientists, you know, play with subspecies, like they call Java Man Homo erectus erectus, because he's the first one, so he's kind of the prototype or archetype, they'll use Pekingensis, you know, for a subspecies for Peking man and this, that sort of thing. But anyway, all right. So that's the basic element there. And then here they get this next paragraph. See, that reminds us of how complicated this is.
The groups going west became less contaminated with the backward stocks of mutual ancestral origin than those going east, who mingled so freely with their retarded animal cousins. These unprogressive individuals drifted southward and presently mated with the inferior tribes. Later on, increasing numbers of their mongrel descendants returned to the north to mate with the rapidly expanding Andonic peoples. And such unfortunate unions unfailingly deteriorated the superior stock. Fewer and fewer of the primitive settlements maintained the worship of the breath giver. This early dawn civilization was threatened with extinction.
Okay. So as you can see, that kind of brings in the question you had way back. You definitely have greater and lesser individuals to begin with, and the lesser ones did tend to drift southward. And plus, they give you this additional east-west differential, right? That the groups going west became less contaminated, Yeah, and some of the reason there is you've got a lot of these near-human stocks in Africa. You know, and if they head westward and kind of north, you know, westward, you're going to minimize how much contamination you might get coming up from Africa from those subhuman stocks. Whereas, you know, as you head to the east, you know, there's a lot of issues with kind of staying north, right? You know, you got the Himalayas and everything, you know, so, you know, there's initial tendency heading east for them to, you know, get heading southeast. And so, you know, those individuals that, no, I don't want to go south at all, whether I'm going east or west at the same time, you know, they wouldn't want to go much east because they would also be going south and they would have a bias against that. So just, you know, for both reasons, there's going to be a tendency for those that went eastward and ended up in Java, right, clear down in Indonesia, right, to have a lot of backmating issues by the time they got there. Right, so that's why you can't just look at Java Man and say, ha ha, this is what Andon Infante looked like. They had, you know, they had almost no forehead at all, or this sort of thing. Or they had big brow ridges, or, you know, you can't judge it by that. Okay.
Or even a scientist would interpret it. They're not a primitive, progressive phenomenon.
Mm-hmm.
They're a regressed phenomenon. They're not.
Yeah. And then as they say, well, what about Peking Man? He's farther to the north. Yes, but look at what they say. Later on, increasing numbers of their Mongol descendants returned to the north to mate with the rapidly expanding Indonic people. So, you know, you would have had some that were trying to stay north and away from that stuff, but then comes the flood from the south, and yeah. So there's going to be a lot of issues to the east of the homeland for the Andonites with backmating. You know, what you want to look for is something, you know, in the northern part of Europe, you know, is going to be most likely the least contaminated. You know, and those of you know the rest, how the paper goes, that's where, you know, the next section goes, is just those peoples that, because of the differential of the more progressive ones wanting to go north and geography allowing them to go more northward when they go westward, right, it ends up naturally being the case that you get some of the best conserved stock up there around France and England. Let's see here. So,
extinction. That means
not
too many left.
Yeah, and so, you brought up that final little chunk that they throw in there. See, it's going beyond just the biologic issues. Fewer and fewer of the primitive settlements maintained the worship of the breath giver. So, in other words, that whole bit of you know, having that spiritual influence, so that you have progressing mind, that potential of progressibility getting actualized, this progressing mind, right, that's going away. There's going to be less and less progression, both internally towards a religious consciousness and externally, in, you know, in terms of the facts of civilization. This early dawn civilization was threatened with extinction. Okay, and remember what I said, how it's appropriate to use that, you know, almost never used term of Eolithic, you know, and interpreting that as a dawn Stone Age. See, this early dawn civilization, right? From 1 million years ago to 500,000 years ago, you know, that the latter part of the what ought to be called the Eolithic, see, is that dawn Stone Age, this dawn civilization. And of course, you can't help but think about it, because I talk about it all the time, a civilization that's threatened with extinction, right? Or at least in our case, a very long interregnum. And you're going, yes, but I mean, this is genetics that they're talking about here that's the problem. That's not like today. You sure? Let's read the final paragraph.
And thus it has ever been on Urantia. Civilizations of great promise have successively deteriorated and have finally been extinguished by the folly of allowing the superior freely to procreate with the inferior.
Politically incorrect revelation. Here it is.
But we really have that happening so extremely right now.
Right. This is, you know, this is where, you know, the truth gets rugged for our current notions, right? You know, everyone who knows the revelation well knows there's several points at which they remind us that the fundamental issue in play is how little Adamic uplift we got. So how tenuous, definitively civilizable, or at least beings who are able to consciousize civilization, how tentative that is on this planet. Right? There's very few people that can really have enough imagination to even imagine civilization, let alone bring it about and maintain it. Okay? And like they say, has it ever been on Urantia? I mean, this has always been the issue throughout the whole million years of human history, that we aren't wise about our procreating. If it moves, we procreate with it, or at least try to. That has brought down every civilization, and so we have to recognize that some of the as they point out in various places in the book. You know, initially you can look at it, it's like, well, what's the big problem? What's corroding our civilization? Well, it's some of these very toxic isms, you know, that we've adopted. But then you find the place in the Revelation where they speak about that ism, you know, that doctrine, that belief system, that worldview, and they say, and guess what the main issue is there? Genetics. We have to remember that your mind is attuned to your genetics. And so if the genetics is poor, the mind is poor. And so the worldview of that mind is unfortunate. So even the better individuals on the planet are quite limited. If they are just what they are naturally, civilization will not endure. We need to be aggressively challenging ourselves to be unnatural, to be an art form, a civilized people, by getting top down on our mind, you know, and imposing some spirit direction by will on the mind. Not just what happens naturally with spirit, you know, related to mind, but beginning to take a hold of the spirit and direct it willfully onto the mind, purposing the mind better. Okay. But even if we all do that, you still have the case, you can't just mate with everything that moves. Because it'll get more and more difficult for you to get a hold of the spirit to impose upon your mind until you can't take a hold of it really at all anymore. Right? I mean, you know, it'll, you know, as you fall down, your hands, you know, the spirit will, its energy will begin to slip through your fingers, and you can't wield it anymore upon your mind, no matter how much you want to. All right, so this always has genetic limits because, you know, we are minds that are seated on a physical foundation, not a spirit energy foundation.
Does that have anything to do with true monogamy? Yes and no?
Well, not immediately, no.
Comment you were making about it.
Yeah, the true monogamy, and for those in the web, are you saying, does that have anything to do with true monogamy? It has
about mating with anything that moves.
Right. Indirectly it does. I mean, it's appropriate for you to think about it. There's all of these upfront issues of just the basic facts of what we are that need to be properly considered. If you're going to get to true monogamy, you need to be genetically selective. Just two blobs of protoplasm with different body parts can't get to true monogamy, right? There has to be something genuinely human on each side that can come together and have a super additive consequence that can have this wholeness of truth that is factually monogamous.
So do you think there's hope in genetic engineering to be able to help with this problem?
Yes, right. I mean, so, right, like we've said so many times, on all planets and on this planet in spades, because of how little natural, quote-unquote, biologic uplift we got, right, most of our biologic uplift is going to be unnatural. It's going to be artificial. It's going to be an art form of genetic engineering. Right? And the more that genetic foundation is uplifted through scientific excellence, which we don't have right now even remotely, the more true monogamy can become. Yeah. And not just true monogamy, but true religion, true monogamy, prayer, and God consciousness, those four indispensables of advancing civilization.
True philosophy.
What?
Oh, you said true.
No, true religion, true monogamy, prayer, and God consciousness. Yeah. Those are the four indispensables to the progress of an advancing civilization. Yep.
Well, I was just thinking that the science aspect to it, or effort, isn't a panacea, though. I mean, it won't have the desired effect unless there's some more holistic effort made.
Yeah. Sure. Yeah, and that's where, you know, you're wondering about philosophy there, and true philosophy. Remember, you need that philosophy and an ever more true philosophy in order for there to be true religion and true monogamy. I mean, it's the philosophic wholeness that, you know, that is the vantage point from which you go down to those parts like religion and marriage and etc. And you definitely are not going to get the, you know, God consciousness, as the, you know, revelators use that term, with anything short of the most excellent mind. You could say right now, by grace, there's a measure of God consciousness, but okay, technically it's God super consciousness. It's not part of your conscious life, what they mean by God consciousness. You're lucky if you consciously have God knowingness.
Yeah.
Okay. God consciousness is so philosophically above God knowing this that it's beyond what anyone can even comprehend. So all those things require the wholeness of a true philosophy, a ripe and integrous human philosophy for a lower hemisphere. And a full-blown, it's in my lap, revelation, divine revelation for the upper hemisphere, synchronized together, and in that wholeness of true philosophy, you know, to reapproach everything. Everything can become new. Marriage can become new. Religion can become new. Paleontology about ancient man can become new. It's important to recognize that it seems our place in the scheme of things on this world to have to deal with, right from the get-go, deal with this issue of genetics very poignantly. The Andonites had no clue that they were on this world where that's the test. But nonetheless, it's been there from the beginning, and it's going to be there for a very long time. We have a very long, difficult path. The wisdom is going to be required to bring this planet forward to light and life in terms of the foundational genetic issues is just so huge. We all know the revelation. They stress it over and over again. Whatever you do, don't just mate with any blob of protoplasm that's curvy, in the other way from you. You got to be wiser about this. but you also don't want to be, ridiculously primitive about it, like you saw in your recent past with the Nazis. That's not what we're talking about here. But we are talking about well genetics. That verboten word, eugenics, which literally means well genetics. Our genetics need to be well. If our genetics are ill, then there's nothing. Right? There can't be civilization predicated on ill genetics, no matter how wishful thinking you are, no matter how much you pray, there won't be civilization. There has to be well genetics. All right, so we'll get next time we'll pick it up there. It starts to get into the meat. Very definitively. We just had a little tease there with Homo erectus and Java man to start with, but it starts to pick up pace quite rapidly, and there's all kinds of, that's related to all these discoveries. Okay, let's take a moment here, everyone.